The latest episode of the Next 5 podcast is all about health prevention and vaccines. I speak to Kate Hashey at GSK.
For every dollar invested in improving health, there's an economic return of $2 to $4.
Murray Aitken at IQVIA Institute for Human Data Science.
The benefits of adult vaccination are compelling.
And David Sinclair at the International Longevity Centre.
Preventable conditions amongst those aged 50 to 64 in the UK cost $27 billion a year.
Listen to the full episode of the Next 5 wherever you get your podcasts.
The latest episode of the Next 5 podcast is out now, and it's all about AI and creativity. I speak to Doug Eck, Senior Research Director at Google DeepMind.
Creativity is part and parcel of humanity.
YouTube creator Danny Vidari.
AI can give us humans new ideas.
And Neil Maiden, Professor of Digital Creativity at City University London.
AI creates a lot of opportunities. I think it's a great leveler.
Listen to the full episode of the Next 5 wherever you get your podcasts. Enjoy.
The FT.
Today we're heading back to 1985. Phyllis Nelson was at the top of the charts with Move Closer, and the FT was moving into the weekend, with this month marking the 30th anniversary of FT Weekend. Today we're going to look back at the first issue and also look forward to this weekend's content, examining the growing black market in nannies and investing in English wine. Welcome to The Money Show, one of the FT's most popular podcasts. I'm Claire Barrett, and I'll be giving you all the week's money news in downloadable form with the help of my FT colleagues Josephine Cumbo and Adam Palin, plus a special studio guest, Paul Killick of Killick & Co. Now, we don't have a birthday cake, but we do have a copy of the first ever issue of the FT Weekend from May 1985, containing our first ever foray into personal finance. A fascinating artefact showing the recent history of investing. We've been struck by the passage of time. Back then, the average savings rate was a glorious 8%. Inflation was touching 6%, now famously in negative territory. And a flat in the newly emerging Docklands district of London could be yours for less than £70,000. A quick look on Zoopla shows us that some flats in that same development are now changing hands for £1.5 million. Now, Paul, you were big in the 1980s. Looking at this issue and drawing on your own memories, what are the pieces of investment history that you recall the most vividly?
The 1980s were very much a period of Thatcher and her ideals, and brought about the privatisations, subsequently the demutualisations. The removal of the life assurance premium relief had a big effect upon the savings market in the United Kingdom, and she encouraged and wanted to encourage people back into the stock market. So it was a very exciting time for us.
Now, you worked on some of those early privatisations.
Yes, indeed. I was running Quilter Goodison's private client department in the 1980s, and we were one of the largest in the United Kingdom. And we put forward an idea to Hawke Vett at the time of the British Telecom privatisation that they ought to appoint us as one of the brokers to the issue. There should be a retail broker. They didn't take that idea, but they took a number of the ideas that we put forward to them. And out of that, we set up share shops inside Debenhams department stores and helped people with the privatisation, completing the prospectus, and then eventually had a permanent share shop inside the Debenhams in Oxford Street.
Now, that share shop, I believe that got you onto News at 10.
It did, yes. About the first time I think a stockbroking firm had ever been shown on News at 10.
Before or since, I'd wager.
Probably right, yes.
Looking back to those days, we can look at the table of interest rates in the 1985 edition of FT Money, or Finance and the Family, as it was called then, and think fondly of the time when savers could enjoy such a great rate. But there were some really big problems for investors back then too, weren't there?
We had a very interesting run in the markets up until about 1987, of course, and then we had the crash of 87, which was a significant setback for investors and caught a lot of people out after a long bull run. I was looking at your copy of the FT of 30 years ago, and the all-share index stood at just over 600, and whereas today it's about 3,800. So, we've gone up six times over that period of time, which probably even outdoes your flat in Docklands. But come 87, we were really cooking. And I remember that the FT 100 share index hit a level of 2,400, up from 1,600 at the beginning of the year. So it rose 50% in that year. And then it lost it all in the space of 3 days. which was a pretty salutary experience for people invested into the market, and particularly those who came in a bit late, as often private investors tend to do, which is always the concern one has.
Yeah, and sadly that trend has continued in subsequent booms and busts. Yes. Now, a year after the inaugural FT weekend hit the newsstands, the Big Bang ushered in probably the biggest change that the City of London at that time had ever seen. Was it for the better?
It's an interesting question. There was good and bad that came out of Big Bang. It's certainly fair to say that we had to go down the route of negotiated commissions. Until October 1986, the London Stock Exchange controlled the rate of commissions paid by or charged by all member firms. It was Appendix 39 of the Stock Exchange rulebook, I remember well.
Oh, your memory.
But I still have a copy of the old Stock Exchange rulebook back at my office as well. But we were about 10 years after the Americans, who deregulated their commissions in 1975. So it was inevitable it was going to happen. Some of the things that one does miss, I think there was a purity in the markets in those days where you were either a stock jobber or you were a stock broker, recognising that a jobber acts as principal on his own book, whereas a broker is acting as agent for the client. And they very sensibly thought there was conflicts in allowing a single organisation to act with both hats on. That went with Big Bang, and companies were allowed to be both principal and agent. And I think that hasn't served markets or investors well, personally. But
it's
the days of the large investment banks which sort of brought that about, and it had to happen from that perspective. Yes.
Now, I've got one final question for you, Paul. Some of the adverts in our first ever edition of the FT Weekend refer to things called Prestel terminals. Do you remember this archaic form of technology? It's lost on
me,
I'm afraid.
Well, one has to remember, of course, that the internet was still a decade or more away before, anyway. Certainly it was in anything like common use. And it was very difficult for people to actually get up-to-date pricing on where shares were. And British Telecom, I think, invented Prestel. You picked it up on your television set.
Kind of like teletext.
It was, yes, absolutely right. But it gave you sort of semi-live pricing. But of course, those prices in those days, we had the floor of the stock exchange, they were collected manually by pink buttons, who used to go round and collect the prices by hand and then go back and key them into terminals.
Wow. So what a great job size.
Not entirely real time.
Well, thanks ever so much, Paul, for sharing your recollections with you. Truly fascinating glimpse into investing past and now for investing future. Still to come on the FT Money Show, we'll be looking at how you can invest in English wine and whether climate change has made it a more attractive investment or indeed tipple. Before that, this week we broke the story of fears that a growing black market in nannies could emerge after new pensions rules add to the cost of hiring a nanny, which could tempt parents, especially in London, to pay cash in hand for carers so that they can save money. Joining me in the studio is Josephine Cumbo, the FT's pensions correspondent. Joe, why are people getting worked up about the change in the pensions regulation this week?
Well, what's happening is that within a few weeks, in June, parents hiring nannies and indeed disabled people who are hiring carers, anyone who hires less than 50 people, will fall into a new duty to pay into a pension for their staff. Now, this has been a duty known as automatic enrolment, which has laid out to the biggest companies in the country since 2012, but it's fanning out to the small employer within weeks.
So now a parent can count as an employer. They've got to provide a pension, they've got to set one up, they've got to choose a scheme, and they've got to pay a contribution every month to that person, whether it's a nanny or a carer. Now, you did some analysis in the FT story. We've worked out that certainly within London, where the cost of everything is more expensive, a typical annual salary for a nanny could be anything over £40,000. So based on that, a 1% contribution plus the fees and charges of setting such a scheme up in the first year could cost parents an additional £500. But then when those contributions rise, and some people are saying that they could go up to 8% in time, although that's speculation, that's obviously going to be a significant chunk. And parents, understandably, are getting quite angry about the burden that is being placed on them on the way that childcare is taxed, because they're already paying for these services out of taxed income.
Yes, that's exactly right. What will happen is that under this new duty, parents and employers will have to pay 1% of a band of earnings, and the minimum contribution will rise to 3% for employers by 2018. Now, the bills, we've done some number crunching, and what it will mean for someone who's hiring a nanny, for example, in London, it's not unusual for someone to be paying 35 to 40K a year. Mm. The contributions for someone who's paying pension for the nanny from this year will be about £30 a month, but by 2018, when those contributions rise, it will grow to about £84 per month. Now, people in the city and in the capital already financially pressed on tight budgets might find it difficult to afford the extra contributions.
And certainly it's not just people in the city who use nannies. Anyone who works irregular hours, yes, whether they're a nurse or...
That's right. Doctors, nurses, exactly. Anyone who can't fit around childcare,
the nursery times,
and have little option but to hire a nanny. So they'll have to take this on board. They'll be getting letters if they've got a PAY reference with HMRC. They'll be receiving letters over the next 2 years to alert them to their new duty.
Now, many people faced with these increased costs, the nanny agencies that you've spoken to this week, they're fearing that they'll try and fly under the radar of the government and HMRC and either do a deal with their nanny so they just pay them in cash and avoid national insurance tax and now the pension, or they'll try and strike some kind of bargain whereby they'll put half of their wages through the books as PAYE and top it up in cash.
Yes, that's what we're hearing, because the pension contributions will be an additional cost, and the cost of that will grow over the next few years. It will move up from 1% of salary to 3%, so it's an increasing cost. Plus, there are costs of setting up the scheme, and some payroll agencies who process the nanny payments also levy charges. So faced with this, these agencies are saying that some parents may choose to go down the riskier route of paying cash in hand. If they have a PAY reference already and they're paying their nanny through the books, they might split the payment into cash in hand to reduce sort of their liability to paying their pension contributions, or they might just go completely under the radar.
Now, obviously, there are huge risks to taking a decision like that. FT Money certainly does not condone people who try and do that. But we have had an enormous response from parents and pensions experts to this article on Twitter this week, perhaps showing that reform is urgently needed in the area of childcare. Now, one final question for you, Jo. When it comes to the nanny's point of view, this legislation hasn't really been thought through for their situation. If you're a nanny, you're looking after children. Hey, children grow up. You're only going to be with one employer for a couple of years at most. Yet with the current legislation, you're going to be left with, 10 more pensions, all separate.
Yeah, their career will be littered with many different jobs and many different employers. So what happens here, if all the employers are doing the right thing and opening up a pension for them, they could end up with lots of little pots being built up, more than the average. I think the average career moves in a lifetime is about 11, but someone who's a nanny who might be in a job for 6 months to 2 years.
Before moving on.
So they'll be building up lots of little pots, which could be quite an admin headache to keep track of. There will be new legislation coming into place in a couple of years' time, 2016, to make it easier for that pot to follow the nanny wherever she goes or whoever might be working, pot follows member. But it remains to be seen what the charges, the frictional costs might be imposed on having that pot follow you around.
Well, some great points there and a story that we will continue to follow closely in the future. Thank you very much, Josephine Cumbo there, the FT's pensions correspondent. Before we pour the wine for our final item, a reminder that you can read FT Money as part of the Weekend FT, which is widely available on both Saturday and Sunday, priced at £3. Or you can read online, subject to registration, at ft.com/money. And you can subscribe via tablet devices for just £99 a year. Now, it's English Wine Week and the corks are popping. The industry appears to be booming. UK wine production reached a record 6.3 million bottles in 2014, many of them consumed by the Barrett-Robertson household, 42% more than in 2013. The number of acres under vines has doubled since 2007, with landowners across swathes of the southern counties turning their land over to more profitable use. And the reason for their enthusiasm is the growing reputation of English sparkling wine and a shared geology with the Champagne region, thanks to climate change. Adam Palin, welcome to the show. It may be an enticing story of the underdog, a much maligned English wine industry maturing to beat its champagne rivals, but is there money to be made?
I think there is. I think in the long term, if you had a few hundred acres and you were producing several hundred thousand bottles, if you think 6.3 million bottles produced last year, say they go for £15 each, it's about £100 million a year industry. Now, as agricultural industries go in the UK, it's not cereal, but it's sizable now, and people around the world are paying attention to English wine, and it's, as you say, it's won awards this week and in the past, and everyone in the sector is very optimistic.
So how seriously are people taking English wine?
Well, in terms of production, there are hobbyists, but over the last two decades, it's professionalised a lot. You have a couple of vineyards, or a couple of wine producers, in fact, that are listed. You have Gusbourne, which in fact is two-thirds owned by Lord Ashcroft, the Conservative peer, but that listed on AIM in 2013. That's expanding very, very quickly down in Kent. And its local peer, Chapel Down, who you might have heard of, their wines stocked in Waitrose, among other places, that's listed on the ISDX Smaller Companies Market. And even though it's relatively small, you've only got revenues about £6 million last year, it's had a lot of coverage.
Are the shares liquid, though?
Oh, very good. Well, they certainly look expensive. They've got similar market capitalisation to Adnams, which is a very highly regarded brewer and distiller out in Suffolk, lovely Southwold. And similar market value, but the revenues of the latter were about 10 times greater, and the profits many, many multiples more.
Sure, so possibly a bit too zingy, as Jilly Goulden might say. Now, I've seen wine producers on crowdfunding websites. Is that a good idea for investors?
Well, I won't get into the merits and demerits of crowdfunding per se, but needless to say, there's high risks involved. I'll take the example of Hambledon, which is the UK's oldest commercial vineyard. They've almost completed a £2.7 million fundraising. It's got about 2 weeks to go. Smaller investors might get wine options, and larger investors, if you're willing to put in £10,000 and up, are promised 8% a year. However, like any mini bonds or crowdfunding investments, they reflect high risks. And in this case, it's a 5-year mini bond, so you don't get anything, maybe half a case of wine each year for 5 years. It might be a case, but either way, this isn't money that you need.
So investors, in short, could be left with a nasty hangover.
Exactly, and you're not covered by the Financial Services Compensation Scheme, I should add.
Now, how about investing in the wine itself? Should I buy bottles of English fizz for my non-existent cellar at home?
Well, lovely as that would be to have several bottles put by for a party, the consensus is do not think of English wine as an investment.
Right.
Sparkling wines, even the best champagnes, very few of them are good to lay down for several years. So the advice is just to drink it.
Now, on that advice, what English wines do you personally recommend, Adam?
Well, out of fear of incurring the wrath of FT wine expert Jancis Robinson, and in my very limited experience as an English wine drinker,
oh, come on,
be an enthusiast, I would recommend the Camel Valley Rosé Sparkling.
It's made down in Cornwall.
Yeah, Cornwall's only very large vineyard, but they've won several awards. Closer to London, I'd say the most highly regarded and ones that I've enjoyed are Nye Timber, very large vineyard down in West Sussex. And in East Sussex, there's Ridgeview down in Ditchling. But you know what? There's a lot of local vineyards. If you're heading out of town for the weekend, have a look. You might be near one.
Well, some fantastic ideas there for the forthcoming bank holiday. Thanks very much, Adam. We'd love to know what you think about our 30th anniversary, the black market in nannies, or about money matters more generally. You can get in touch via email. The address is money@ft.com, or you can tweet us at ftmoney. And you can leave comments at the foot of individual articles on our website at ft.com/money. There's just time to tell you what else is in this week's edition. Terry Smith takes a bite out of McDonald's. Lucy Kellaway riffs on her first ever column in FT Money 30 years ago, naturally in column form. And there's the latest on disputed film finance schemes. And as usual, we've shared tips from our sister publication, The Investor's Chronicle, and the latest director's deals. The FT Money Show will be back next week, but for now, it's goodbye from me, from Josephine, Adam, and our special studio guest, Paul Killick.
For more downloads, go to ft.com/podcasts.
The latest episode of The Next Five podcast is out now, and it's all about AI and creativity. I speak to Doug Eck, Senior Research Director at Google DeepMind.
Creativity is part and parcel of humanity.
YouTube creator Danny Vidari.
AI can give us humans new ideas.
And Neil Maiden, Professor of Digital Creativity at City University London.
AI creates a lot of opportunities. I think it's a great leveler.
Listen to the full episode of The Next Five wherever you get your podcasts. Enjoy.
The latest episode of The Next Five podcast is all about health prevention and vaccines. I speak to Kate Hashey at GSK.
For every dollar invested in improving health, there's an economic return of $2 to $4.
Murray Aitken at IQVIA Institute for Human Data Science.
The benefits of adult vaccination are compelling.
And David Sinclair at the International Longevity Centre.
Preventable conditions amongst those aged 50 to 64 in the UK cost $27 billion a year.
Listen to the full episode of The Next Five wherever you get your podcasts.